This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on May 5th, 2011. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The Federal Election Commission will come to order. The first item on our agenda is the correction and approval of minutes. Vice Chair, do we have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move to approve agenda document number 11-21, minutes for the open session held on April 7th, 2011.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries 6-0. The next item on our agenda is the proposed final audit report on the Service Employees International Union Committee on Political Education. Mr. Silowski and Mr. Hintermeister, please proceed when ready.
As Commissioner Bowerly just stated, just before you, the proposed final audit report for SEIU COPE. During the audit, the scope of the audit included a bank reconciliation, a limited review of occupation, name of employer, and it focused primarily on independent expenditures made by the committee. After our reviews, we discovered no material non-compliance issues, and that's stated in our proposed report that it's basically a no-finding report. However, attached, in the memo to the report is an item for your discussion regarding the transfers that the SSF made to the connected organization for independent expenditures and their disclosure.
Thank you. Is there a discussion on the report? I'll be happy to go first. Thank you for the report, and I think the report reaches the conclusions that are of the legal issue that is described in the memo. From my perspective, I'm not comfortable supporting this outcome in this report. I understand the rationale and the discussion behind the detail that was provided in the cover memo about the MERS that were looked at, the AOs that were looked at. But I'm concerned that this analysis can undermine the type of disclosure that's already required by the statute. And I don't think that the AOs are exactly on point, and this is a factual difference that is important. The statute and commission regulations require political committees to itemize any independent expenditures, the recipient of those independent expenditures that add up to or exceed $200 in the calendar year. And in this matter, unlike some of the AOs that were that the commission has approved in the past, this was not the advance payment for example, the salaries of the employees of the connected organization. Rather, these expenditures were made to the funds were transferred to SEIU, who then simply paid them to other vendors, locals, that sort of thing. My reading of the statute is that those recipients, the locals or the vendors themselves, should have been reported. And so rather than the no finding in this report, I would actually support a finding that for the 38 disbursements from SEIU COPE to the SEIU General Fund totaling over $14 million, that there was inadequate itemization and reporting of the individuals or entities who received the payment for the independent expenditures. As a result, the finding would also note that audit was unable to verify the dates of the public dissemination for the independent expenditures and the timeliness of any 24-hour or 48-hour notices or the use of proper disclaimers. And so I would, in that finding then, if were that to be adopted, I would assume that there would be additional reporting that would be required to fix those prior reports. Again, I think this is a factual difference from the AOs that have approved some of these advance payment with respect to employees, and this is slightly different than the Mondale AO where there was a vendor involved. I agree that vendor, if you're paying to a vendor, you don't have to itemize for every FedEx payment that vendor might make on your behalf, but the vendor has to appear in the reports. Here, what it appears is that this was either an accounting or a convenience for how the money flowed to the locals and flowed out of the organization. And Post Citizens United SEIU could have made these independent expenditures directly, so I'm not sure that this issue would arise again. But under the current regime, the transfer, the bulk transfer of the money from the COPE to SEIU, in my view, doesn't alleviate the reporting issue with respect to the recipient of those funds for the IE. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with your analysis. I want to emphasize that this would, we're not suggesting that SEIU, or at least I'm not suggesting that SEIU did anything wrong, only that a fuller reporting of their activities would be more consistent with the statute and would provide the public with a better view of what these independent expenditures were all about. I think that's what we ought to do, and I would be happy to make a motion to reflect that. Oh, and I just noticed Commissioner McGann's tie. Wow, that is even better than your other pink tie. I really like that one. Just was struck by that.
We'll see.
That has nothing to do with my motion.
Yeah, well, that's, we'll see what it has to do with the vote, too.
Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, and thank you. I'm confused. So the union didn't do anything wrong, but they didn't do the reports correctly. But isn't that something that's wrong?
All I meant to say is that it's just a reporting issue. It's not a, you know,
okay.
They didn't take in money or spend money in some inappropriate way. It's just a reporting issue.
Okay. I can't support a finding here for a couple different reasons. First, they didn't do anything wrong, whether it's just a reporting issue or not. The reports are correct. I think the auditors questioned it, took it to the Office of General Counsel. The Office of General Counsel agrees that they don't have to break down their IE reports any more than they did. There's nothing in the reg that indicates that. Counsel went the extra mile and looked at some old AOs and MERS to see if the commission had created anything new that wouldn't be found in the reg text. But when you do an IE, you have to show who you paid, and that's all you have to show. You don't have to break it down. And here, to say that they do, I think is unprecedented and is radically different than how most who do IEs think they need to report them. To use this case to impose a new rule, I think, is improper because, well, an audit is not the place to do that, particularly when you have a lot of folks, including this particular union, who do IEs, and they do it in a manner consistent with how this union did it. Simply because they're a union moving money to locals or whatnot, to me, is a red herring. It's still the same reporting regime, whether you're a party committee or a union or whatnot. And I've always thought the rule has to be the same for everyone, yet has to give enough breathing room for everyone. So I don't see this as an opportunity to create a different rule for a union because they move money a little bit differently. They have to report it differently than someone else. Two, the second issue is to make a finding is somewhat odd because I don't know of a case, and maybe there is, where the auditors are not recommending a finding, but the commission is going to insert their own finding. Generally, it's on the auditor's recommendation. We may not adopt the finding, but to undo that, to me, means it's not a question of fact, it's a question of law. So that betrays that we are talking about what the rule is. And two, to make a finding here is improper because the committee has really had no opportunity to be heard on the issue. There's been no notice on this. I think we received an email from them late yesterday that the first they heard of this was, well, then, as soon as they sent the email. Since I've joined the commission, we've spent a lot of time working through due process concerns and having an opportunity to be heard, and we've come a long way. The commission is a completely different place than it was almost 3 years ago when some of us showed up because there's a lot more opportunity to be heard, and I don't want to see that reversed by imposing a finding on an issue that, well, the committee or the union has not had a chance to really brief because, well, our own Office of General Counsel says it's not a problem. And this is not a hypothetical. I mean, if you look at the notion of due process, it applies not only in the criminal context but in the civil context. And I would suggest here, many over the years tend to make the reflexive claim that such things don't really concern the FEC because it's an administrative agency and we don't really have our own power. We have to go to court and that sort of thing. But I'm not sure that's true. I remember the case of Wisconsin v. Constantino, where in Wisconsin a local sheriff decided he was going to post on local liquor store walls who he thought couldn't handle alcohol because they were a public disturbance or whatnot. No opportunity to be heard, no charging document, no trial. He did that, and they took him to court, and the Supreme Court said, nice try. Justice Douglas, speaking for the court, said, where a person's good name, reputation, honor, or integrity is at stake because of what the government is doing to him, notice and an opportunity to be heard are essential. Posting under the Wisconsin Act may, to some, be merely a mark of illness. To others, it is a stigma, an official branding of a person. The label is a degrading one. Now, we're not labeling SEIU an alcoholic, but in the world of campaign finance, you are branding them with a finding that really, to me, doesn't have a legal basis and for which they have not had an opportunity to be heard. And that's something we can't do. Even if I were inclined to use the audit as an opportunity to create a new rule, I certainly wouldn't do so without giving them an opportunity to at least present their legal arguments, particularly here where we already have a legal view that what they did is not a problem. And third, there's been a lot of talk about disclosure, and if we can't simply take every opportunity that presents itself to somehow make people file more detailed reports simply because that's a policy preference of the current thinking of some. The rule is the rule. The rule says it does not require them to do this. We can't do this at the audit stage. So I cannot support a finding. I actually objected to this audit report for different reasons, which was the concern that there would be things on the public record that could cause some in the public to think the union did something wrong. And I brought it to the table to ensure that it was clear that they did not, that their reports were correct as filed, and that no one can take an inference down the road that, well, the auditors may have wanted to find something, but the commission got in the way or the council got in the way or anything like that. That's not the case here. I think the rule is clear. And that's the reason why I brought it to the table, really for the opposite reason that others did. So I can't support the idea of a finding. That's my piece on this.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's part of that I actually agree with. And this comes to us in an odd procedural posture. Because there's no finding, it didn't come before the commission until this very late stage in the process. And that's why we're raising it now, because it wasn't really in front of us before this. But I think it would be appropriate to send it back, basically to return it to the interim audit phase to provide an opportunity for SEIU to brief the issue, to make a presentation before the commission if they choose to do so. I think that would be perfectly appropriate. The problem for me is that this issue, the only point at which this issue was raised to me was here at this late stage. But I think that would be an appropriate thing to do, and I'd been planning to make a motion that we include a finding, but I think it would probably be more appropriate to make a motion that we send it back to audit to prepare a report that would be effectively an interim audit report that the union would then have an opportunity to respond to, because I think that point is entirely well taken. Not that I expect that you're going to support that either, but, I think on the procedural grounds, you're right.
Commissioner Weintraub. Commissioner McGann.
I appreciate that. And a lot of the procedural changes that have come in have been commission-wide, and I'm not taking a bow solo. We all take a bow for much of this. Particularly, Commissioner Walter has had quite a few good ideas on this front that I think has made things better. Here, though, I don't see a legal. I guess we'll see how the votes go, because at the end of the day, I would be prepared to, with a few modifications to make sure that the final report's clear, support the report that's in front of us. Now, if there's not enough votes to close the file, then I guess it does go back. I don't see why we would need to do that. They've already been through an audit. You know, the process is the penalty, so to speak. They've been through enough, in my view. To me, it's a legal issue. We don't have in front of us, to me, a presentation of the legal issue saying that what they did was wrong. So to give them an opportunity to respond, the question I ask is, respond to what? Because counsel is kind of agreeing with the union, because I'm not sure the union's not going to say, counsel's wrong, you're right, we should have reported it more, with more detail. They're probably going to say, we don't have any problem. So I'm not sure what they're responding to. So I guess I'm curious if given that may end up just causing it to run around the track a couple more times and end up right where we are, is that something that still makes sense? Because I just don't understand what they would be responding to.
They would be some of us would be proposing a finding, and not making the finding, but you know, proposing a finding that the union could respond to. I'm delighted to see that you are so deferential to our counsel's office that you think that the fact that they have made a recommendation sort of ends the analysis.
Well, a broken clock does tell the right time twice a day.
As I think you would not disagree, sometimes people disagree with the recommendations of the counsel's office. Sometimes people disagree with the recommendations of the auditors. The auditors did raise a question about this. I don't think that they thought this was a slam dunk. Our lawyers that did an analysis, and I think, as the chair said, we think there are distinctions between some of the AOs and the facts that are in front of us. That actually does, there are distinctions in fact that lead to a different legal conclusion on some of our parts, but I am absolutely happy to hear from SEIU on this point. I don't think that the process questions are lightly taken.
Could I ask a question? Where in the regs, though, does it say they need to do what you're suggesting? Even if the AOs don't squarely address the issue before us, that's not really the ultimate question, because the AOs are not the source of the rule. It's, well, the regulations. And the way the regs read, what this union did seems to be wholly consistent with the actual regulatory language. We can't really have them respond to whether or not they come within AOs, because that seems to not really be the question.
Well, I think that the regulation left some room for interpretation, and that's why there was recourse to the AOs.
The regulations require the reporting of the recipient of the expenditure for the AOs when it aggregates over $200. In this matter, as I understand it, SEIU moved the money to SEIU, who then paid the people who were the recipients of those funds. There seemed to be more of an accounting measure rather, because at that point in time SEIU couldn't make independent expenditures. They moved the money through the accounts of SEIU and paid locals. As you pointed out, that the money movement to locals is very common. And if they had reported the recipient locals, I would be fine with that. But that's not what happened. They reported a significant, you know, amount, some to the in one instance $3 million of a transfer, and then they seemed that carried that forward and then reported some disbursements from that, but never to to the recipient local. If they had reported the locals, I'd be fine with that.
Can I ask a question? And tease this out a little bit, because I think the rule has to apply to everyone. Let's say a national party committee transfers money to a state party committee, which then does an independent expenditure. Not as common nowadays, but was very common back in the issue ad days, where they would move a mixture of hard and soft money to a state party and then pay for an issue ad, or they could pay for an IE. They do it all hard. But for whatever reason, they want the state party to do it, or they're funding it. Would they have to? Would the national party then show an IE to the state party's, you know, media production company, or would it just be a transfer and then the state party would show the IE? Because to me, it seems this like the same kind of national versus local issue.
Except for the unlimited transfer opportunity between national parties, between party committees. So we don't...
But why does that change on the IE side? Because IEs are unlimited. You still have... The limit issue doesn't really rear its head in IEs either.
But for IEs, the recipient is... SEIU COPE was reporting IEs. They were... This is their reporting of IEs.
Right.
And so my concern is they're not reporting the recipient. They're reporting the account through which the money was transferred to the locals.
Okay, let me try another hypo. Let's say a state party wants to do essentially the same sort of program that this union did, which I'm reading one of the, let's see, what is this? This is a memo from the staff director's side about this, and it says the purpose was, quote, door-to-door voter ID and get out the vote efforts supporting. In this case, it was Barack Obama opposing John McCain. So let's say a state party hired a consultant to do the same thing, and they did one IE report that said, we're paying consultant X to do an IE, and the description is door-to-door voter ID and get out the vote efforts. Would they have to then break that all down, or is that a sufficient report for the party under the approach you want to impose on this union?
Well, that, I think, was answered by the Mondale AO. If there's a vendor involved, then that's the recipient of the funds, and you don't have to break down the vendor's individual or specific spending of that IE expenditure.
Then what's the difference between the Mondale AO and the union? Because maybe we're just going to disagree, but I don't see them as particularly distinguishable unless you start treating people differently. And it's odd because you do have to treat people differently to a certain extent because, well, they do things slightly differently, but the rule doesn't change. It has to allow folks to do essentially the same thing the same kind of way, and I'm having trouble seeing why the union would have to break it down but a party committee wouldn't. I guess the local's not the same as a vendor?
In this instance, I think the local is like the vendor.
Well, that would bring you within Mondale, right?
Sorry?
Wouldn't that bring you within the Mondale AO?
Not in this instance, where the money moved from COPE to SEIU, and that's all that's being reported. We're not getting the reporting of the local. As I said, if they were reporting the funds that... the aggregate transfer, the bulk transfer that was made to SEIU, if the funds that were transferred to the locals are being reported, I don't think any of us are talking about individual employees or individual expenditures by the local for every piece of that IE expenditure, but just reporting the transfer to SEIU means that the recipient of the IE is not actually reported.
How would they know to report it that way? I mean, it's just reporting, but I would think the reporting obligations ought to be sufficiently clear that we shouldn't have really this much of a difference in views. How would they know, short of being audited and then having a finding imposed on them, that they're not quite doing it the way some think they ought to do it?
Well, by my reading of the regulation, the recipient is not the is not SEIU.
Okay.
Commissioner McGann.
Thanks. I think one way to move this along. And I hear that not everyone is going to support the report as drafted, but I think it's important to firm that up now, and then once we see how that goes, then we discuss Plan B. I have a couple technical concerns with the report as drafted, and that's on page one, where it has limitations. This is rather standard that the auditor, you know, auditors will limit the scope of their audit. You see this with big accounting firms, so that, you know, when people rely on the audit for company mergers or whatnot, they know the limits of the audit. Here, however, the way these limitations read could be misconstrued down the road and make it look like, well, the auditors really didn't look at $14 million worth of IEs to verify certain things. And therefore, it leaves somewhat of a potential cloud. So I would either prefer to just strike it all together, or add a sentence that says something to the effect of audit did not discover any material noncompliance. Because this kind of language makes me a little nervous. So I'd like to move that we adopt the audit report in front of us, striking the limitations language, and make any technical and conforming changes to remove such language throughout the audit. And we'll see how that goes, and that may end the matter. And if not, then we have to discuss where we go from here.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The problem that I have with doing it in that order is that I know where it goes from there. If that motion fails, then it goes to additional issues under the, you know, process that we have laid out. And And then there would be no opportunity for somebody else to say, no, we want to do this differently. We want to send it back to audit so that they can propose a new finding that the union would then have the opportunity to respond to. So I guess I would like to make a substitute motion.
I think I'm not sure you're correct that it goes into other issues. That's on proposed findings. This is not a proposed finding. There's no proposed findings, so this doesn't go to other issues. It would just be struck, and the report would be adopted otherwise as it appears. And where it says commission findings, it says that in pertinent part, audit staff did not discover any material noncompliance. So I'm confused by what would drop into other issues.
I guess I'm going to, because our audit processes seem to be still a work in progress, I'm going to ask counsel for a little bit of guidance. Should this motion fail, will I then have the opportunity to make a motion to send this back to audit to effectively brief this issue for the union so that they can then brief their response back to us?
That would be in order.
All right.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
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 I'm sorry. One moment. My bad.
Following your lead.
Sorry. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. Motion fails 3-3. Are there other motions? Commissioner Weintraub.
All right. I'll give this a try. This is an unusual motion because we find ourselves in an unusual procedural posture. I move that we return this matter to audit in order for them to draft a proposed finding that would reflect that the audit staff identified 38 disbursements totaling $14,427,267 from SEIU COPE to SEIU, which were then dispersed by SEIU on behalf of SEIU COPE to numerous entities for independent expenditures. That SEIU COPE did not adequately itemize and report the recipient, individuals, and or entities that received payments for the independent expenditures from the account of SEIU, SEIU COPE's connected organization. That due to the lack of itemization of these independent expenditures, audit was unable to verify the dates of the public dissemination for the independent expenditures and the timeliness of any 24-hour or 48-hour notices filed or the use of proper disclaimers for any public communications contained in those expenditures, and that SEIU COPE should amend its reports to correct its reporting. That report would then effectively be back in the interim audit phase. It would be presented to the union for their response, and if they so chose, for ultimately for a hearing. And we would basically be sort of winding the clock back on this audit and returning it to an earlier phase, which I admit is a unusual procedure for us. But I don't know any other way to do it, given that the interim, this issue wasn't, would, had they proposed a finding, it would have been raised to us at the interim audit phase. Since the finding wasn't proposed, we're sort of left at the end of the process with this unresolved issue. And I'm open to other ways of attempting to resolve it, but I can't think of any off the top of my head.
Commissioner Walter?
I just had a question of Mr. Stoltz. I gather that had you not sent it to OGC for an opinion, would there have been a finding by your office to that effect?
And sorry, I missed
that. Had it not been sent to the office, OGC, for an opinion, in your office itself, had you reached a conclusion as to whether or not a finding should be made?
You know, just given the cover memo on this, I don't think it would come as a surprise to anybody that this question generated quite a bit of discussion at the staff level with you know, both in audit and between audit and OGC as to where this fits. You know, the Mondale AO talks about vendors, and of course the classic deal is we don't care where the printer buys his ink. On the other hand, you know, if you transfer money to your payroll service to do payroll, you have to report who you paid, not the payroll service. So where does this fall? And council spent considerable time and effort researching and came up with a conclusion that's reflected in the cover memo, and so we presented it to you that way. It's an interesting question as to what the necessary disclosure in this sort of case should be.
Thanks.
Commissioner McGann.
I guess I have a question on how this plays out, because I'm not inclined to support the motion for the reason that I don't see the finding materializing in any meaningful way. Meaning, first, I'm still not sure what they're responding to. They seem to be responding to error, not really a proposed finding. Now, I guess the proposed finding is they should have done their reports differently. But why would they not just attach what OGC's prepared and say, see attachment A. And they probably will put some additional argument in there. But it doesn't make sense to keep these folks under the thumb of the audit process. And I'm not sure what is to be gained by sending it back to them for them to spend more resources preparing a brief and asking for a hearing and all that to persuade commissioners to maybe affirmatively rule in their favor. Is it that we can get four votes to say what they did is affirmatively correct? So there's some interest in doing it this way, because I don't see four votes to make the finding that they did something wrong. So if that's the goal, then it doesn't make any sense to send it back. If the goal is that maybe there could be a fourth to come my direction, which is what they did is correct, then there's a balancing over, is that really worth using SEIU COPE as the person who essentially funds the briefing on all that, which is an issue that really the commission ought to be able to do without keeping them under the thumb. So I'm not sure where this comes out. And I guess that's my first question, is there hope that someone moves our direction? If not, then what's the point of going further down the road? And then two, I guess this is for the chair, but probably also for council, but it's in the opinion of the chair, if the current motion goes 3-3, what happens then? Will we close the file, or would we just sit in limbo? Because I'm trying to just play this out as to where this ends up, because I'm not sure what sending it back accomplishes, I'm not sure what if we just keep going back and forth and going 3-3 on and this never gets resolved. I'm just curious on how this ends up.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Well, I'll address your first question, which is, you know, is there, if you're asking, is my mind entirely made up and closed and I just feel like making the union's lawyers spend some more time writing a brief? No. I think there's an issue here. I'm not confident that the document that's in front of us has resolved it in the correct way. I think that you have, as you have said, and I agree with you on this, it's important to give the union the opportunity. You know, it's one thing to get advice from our lawyers, but they don't have as much invested in this as the union does. Union may come up with different arguments. They may present it differently. I'm always happy to engage with the lawyers on the other side and hear what they have to say. Could I be persuaded? Sure. Right now I'm not persuaded that the opposite is true, but could I be persuaded that you're right? Yeah, I think sure.
Question again.
What's awkward is we've put in place a procedure where if there's going to be a finding, the committee that's been audited has an opportunity to be heard, so at least we know what they would prefer. I could see this particular union going one of two ways. They may say, just close the file and let us go. Or they could say, actually, even if it doesn't mean we have four votes saying what we did was correct, we wouldn't mind an opportunity to drop a letter in the file saying we think we're absolutely right. So that way, at least we're on the public record, we have a statement that says we don't think any of this adds up to anything, and we're completely in the clear. I mean, they may want to do that to have their own bite at the apple. Sometimes you see it's more common in MERS, where a MER will close and someone will send a letter wanting to put it on the public record because they feel like they weren't, you know. And I think that there's cases. I think there was one years ago. You were a defense lawyer, and you sent such a letter.
I did.
And so sometimes...
Wow, you read it? I'm impressed.
And, Susan Bass Levin, was that the respondent? Was it that case?
Could have been.
New Jersey ran against Jim Saxton in 2000,
2000, I believe.
I remember Ms. Levin. I can't swear that was the case, though.
It may have been. I don't know. I didn't look that up before the meeting. That was just
very impressive.
That was just off the cuff. So we're sitting here, and we have you know, folks I recognize, not because we run in the same circles, but because they do business before the commission, who are the folks being audited. And we can't ask that. I would love to ask them, do you want another bite at the apple to clear your name, or do we just, or do I hold the line here and just and say, let's just close the file? So I don't know if it'd be in order to ask the chair. Can we ask them? Can I move, if we have four votes, ask them what they would want to do? Because it, procedurally, we've put in a position, we're in a position where we thought we fixed this problem, where we sit here and we watch them, and we can't talk to them. It's bizarre, and we fixed this, and now here we are. And we're back in Alice in Wonderland, where we have this divide. My guess is they may say, put us out of our misery, but they may want to file a letter.
Commissioner Walter.
Well, you've got four votes to ask them what they want to do.
Well, I think... if I might, I think what would be in order is often in this, we don't have a procedure where we, like in AOs, where we ask representatives of the interested party to sit at the table. What we do often in audit is relay information through the auditors. The auditors receive information, as we did this morning, received it. So what may be in order, and I think I'd ask Mr. Calvert this, is if the commission took a recess and the auditors consulted with the audited committee, and we're able to transmit that information. We just don't have a procedure.
I understand.
And
that's why I was asking what the chair thought would do. You're the chair. So as I understand it, we recess, the auditors turn around and ask the guys in the front row, who then tell the auditors, who turn back around and tell us.
That's my question for Mr. Calvert, if that would be in order.
Game of telephone.
Yes. That would be in order.
Thank you. So the commission will recess for 5 minutes. The open meeting will resume. Mr. Hintermeister? Oh, Mr. Stoltz is coming back.
The committee has indicated to me that they agree with the conclusion of the memo and the legal basis that was represented in that memo. They believe that it was a fair question to bring to the table, and they don't believe that a finding would be warranted in the report and don't see the basis for going back to the interim report stage. The committee did indicate that they would like to see some sort of rulemaking from the commission in the future, and they would be happy to be involved in that process and would follow any guidance that would be come out of that rulemaking. And they wanted to make sure, and just the legal basis, that there is no regulation out there that indicates that any further disclosure was warranted in this case.
So that's a no, I think, to Commissioner McGann's question.
Plus, they don't understand what would be gained by sending it back to the...
Right, I understand that.
So I believe there is a motion on the table to send it back to the interim audit stage to present this proposed finding and follow the procedures that would flow from that stage of our process. Any questions on the motion? Any discussion? Commissioner McGann.
So my motion was supplanted by Commissioner Weintraub. So Commissioner Weintraub's.
I believe we voted on your motion.
You did. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
You can remember my clients from 20 years ago, and you can't remember the
motion.
And
I misspoke. It was actually
ago?
Tierney. It was. I had the wrong merge. It was a self-funding issue. Sorry, I misspoke. Yes. Wrong merge.
So the motion is no. Is there any further discussion of the motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
No. Motion fails 3-3. Are there any further motions? Commissioner Weintraub.
We've been talking about this. I think. Well, let me ask counsel, because we could do a couple of things here. There is a finding in the report that was presented to us, that audit staff did not discover any material noncompliance. Now, I don't know whether, my question for our council is, if we, does the rejection of Commissioner McGann's motion mean that this issue automatically goes to additional issues in the actual final report that would be the next stage in this process? Or if I wish to have this issue discussed in additional issues, do I have to make a separate motion to reject the commission finding that is in this report? I'm happy to do that, but if I don't have to, that's fine too.
Mr. Calvert?
I think our conclusion is, and I do want to caveat this a little bit, but I think our conclusion is that you wouldn't need to make an additional motion. I would note that that there was an additional part to Commissioner McGann's motion. It was not merely to approve the report, but was to approve the report with a modification relating to the language about the scope limitation. But the applicable provision of the commission directive states that for any recommended finding that does not receive four or more votes either approving or rejecting the recommendation, the audit division will move the discussion to an additional issues section. Each additional issue will contain a brief summary of the facts, any applicable legal standards, a brief recitation of the audit division's recommendation, and a statement describing the commission's discussion of the issue, and a recitation of the vote on the recommended finding. We would be in a situation in which the recommended finding, which is that there was no material noncompliance discovered on the part of the committee, would not receive four or more votes either approving or rejecting the recommendation. So it would appear that the thing to do at that point would be to move the discussion into an additional issues section.
Okay. Well, in that case, although I would have welcomed further briefing and conversations with SEIU on this, if, you know, I understand it's their choice to just close the door. That's their option. I move that we reject the finding in the audit report of SEIU. Is it an audit report on SEIU COPE? Excuse me. That is in front of us.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No. Motion fails 3-3. At this point, it's my understanding that the audit report will go back to the audit division for further drafting.
That is
correct.
Is there
any further procedure we need to take at the table here today?
Not at this time.
Okay. Thank you very much. The next item on our agenda is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on Freedom's Defense Fund.
Just that. Don't let me run one with your
copies. Good morning, Mr. Bonowitz. Please proceed when ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry about that entrance. Good morning, everybody. Before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on Freedom's Defense Fund, which recommends you approve the finding as presented in the draft final audit report. That finding involved disclosure of independent expenditures. In response to the interim audit report recommendation, FDF provided additional information that established $62,499 in independent expenditures. FDF amended its reports to disclose all but $11,869 as independent expenditures. Appropriate 24 and 48-hour notices were not filed for independent expenditures totaling as much as $43,498. We are prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on the Audit Division's recommendation memorandum? Commissioner Weintraub.
Never mind.
Commissioner McGann.
Thanks. The the issue here is that the auditors had thought maybe some things were some ads were express advocacy, and it turns out that the commission didn't agree with all of that. They agreed with some of it. And the thought I had was that the audit report wasn't particularly clear on that point and some other points, because sometimes when the auditors go down a road and then it turns out it wasn't quite the road the commission would go down, it makes the audit report look a little clunky. I can approve this, which is the draft today, but I look forward to working with my colleagues to revise it to explain what happened procedurally, so the public can learn a little bit about what happened here, and provide a little more clarity in the explanation of the findings, so that people know what's going on. And I'd circulated some language. I want to make clear, I'm not to my colleagues, I'm not wedded to that language, and certainly, you know, open to feedback or whatnot. And I'm mindful that we all share the goal of having essentially a fixed template for audits, but sometimes things are a little bit different audit to audit, so sometimes the template requires a little bit of tweaking to make it reflect the reality of the audit. So I think this is doable, and I appreciate the work that and the cooperation I've received thus far, but I'm just trying to make it a little more clear of a document. So we can vote for this today and then do the cleanup after the fact to move it along.
Thank you. And one of the issues that you had raised, which I agree, this may have been one of the first instances that we used the procedure under our new Directive 69, and I think you had suggested that be reflected in the report, and I think that makes sense. I think it was one where, at the end of the day, the Commission did not actually act upon it, so the guidance went forward under the directive as proposed by the Council's office. So that should just be reflected, I think, in the report, because it makes clear why the auditors took the action that they did. So I'll support the recommendation as is as well, and happy to work on any clarifying language to make clear what the Commission is actually voting on and concluding in the final report. Is there any further discussion? Is there a motion?
I move that we adopt the draft final audit report that's before us regarding the Freedoms Defense Fund.
Any discussion on the motion? Mr. Stoltz, before.
One technical point. This is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum, which is a slightly different step.
Oh, thank you,
in the process.
Right, right. I should have actually read the agenda, because that tells me what to say. Now I have it in front of me. So I move the agenda item.
Number 1122, in fact.
Right. That, yes, that's 1122, yes. Whatever that is, that's what I move.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Thank you very much, Mr. Stoltz and Mr. Bonowitz.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is a policy regarding disclosure of documents and information in the enforcement process. Vice Chair, we have some late submitted documents.
Thank you. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda document numbers 11-23, 11-23A, and 11-23B.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries 6-0. We have several members of our General Counsel's office joining us here at the table to answer any questions that commissioners might have. This agenda item was placed on the agenda at the request of the Vice Chair. It's a procedure that the entire commission has been discussing for some time. I'll turn it over to any of my colleagues who wish to discuss any of the documents before us. Commissioner Walter.
I'll be glad to get started. This is a policy that we have discussed for some time, and pardon my voice, hope it doesn't fail me, because it has occasionally weakened on me. This policy is something that I was surprised, I guess, in time in various instances that we don't have, and that's really a policy, internal written policy, on when we will or will not, and to what extent we provide respondents with information regarding matters which are being investigated for possible violations. And in a recent case, it became starkly apparent to me that we needed a policy like this, and I felt that we should begin to draft one. The most agencies, I think, have some parameters by which they embrace the disclosure of documents gathered during an investigative process. We don't have anything formal like the kind that's before us today. In thinking about that, and one of the issues that came to mind, as I say, also starkly, was the issue with respect to providing information which may tend to be exculpatory in nature or may tend to benefit a defense of a respondent. And there is a Supreme Court case that makes that an obligation constitutionally in criminal proceedings. There are recommendations by the American Bar Association, which are in place in many courts, that impose that as well in some aspects of a professional obligation to, not just a constitutional obligation, to achieve a satisfactory degree of fairness and due process. So in trying to craft something, my thought was to take a look at not only what we generally do that may be negative to somebody's case, but also what's also positive to someone's case. And so this particular draft that I asked for commission consideration basically takes the Brady theory of disclosure of exculpatory evidence into consideration, provides for methodology by which that would be disclosed to respondents, and also, of course, provides for other relevant information that's gathered in the course of an investigation to be made available to respondents. In doing this, there were some matters that seemed to not be quite so clear as I'd like to make them now. The policy that I'm asking the commission to consider does not expand on documents that normally would be, conversely, does not limit the documents that normally would be withheld by us, by the commission, in the form of ones that are privileged in nature, ones that constitute work product, ones that constitute information obtained from other governmental entities for which we have an agreement, or maybe anything, of course, that would be confidential by law. So let me make that clear. It doesn't provide for a handing over of those documents any more than we would do them now. But what it does is takes a look at those other documents and say, okay, let's take the documents that we've gathered in the course of an investigation against a respondent, and what would those be? First of all, you take the balance that's left after you exclude those, and so this provides that anything that's immaterial or not relevant would not be included, that anything that's already in their possession is not included, or should clearly be in their possession is not included. Anything that's in the public eye or ascertainable through public information is not included. So then we remove those documents from what needs to be disclosed, and you go down to what's really relevant documents that they don't have that we know we have. They're in our possession, and they're not ones that we go out to seek to get, but they're already in our possession. This provides that there's a time, not a daily instance time where we have to continue to do it, but there is a time during the process by which disclosure would be made. Now, we already say that when we file documents, when we file a probable cause brief, documents that are cited in that brief will be made known to the respondent. Well, that sounds reasonable. But it seems to me that if we're really talking about fairness and due process, There's no institutional reason why our agency should want to conceal the documents we already have, which are relevant, which are either favorable to or negative to a respondent who's facing a governmental investigation. If we feel that way, then I don't think we've articulated through our general counsel or ourselves as a commission when those institutional situations exist. This particular document provides for a time when it's either at the probable cause stage or during pre-probable cause conciliation, when those relevant documents would be made available. And this shouldn't come to a surprise that this has happened. This happens throughout the country in a number of prosecutorial areas in administrative agencies. And I would also add, and it's well stated in the document that's on file, that there are federal agencies that have clearly made files available similar in this way, and sometimes at different times based upon their own structure and the course of their investigative process. I think we need one. I think we need to show that we're not afraid to give documents that hurt someone's case that we quite haven't produced yet, maybe because they haven't been particularly asked for, when our investigation is completed, or if we're in a stage when we want to enter into pre-probable cause conciliation. I recognize that this is breaking some new ground, but it's something we do every day. It's something we face every day, and we just do it without really having it in writing, one way or the other. Some things we don't do that I suggested here, but the process deals with each of these issues, and it's really done based upon tradition, some memoranda, and some just what's in the best opinion of the general counsel. This also provides for a basis by which the general counsel can come to the commission when the general counsel sees an issue with respect to documents to be withheld for guidance on where to go. Yes, go ahead. Privileged documents, the commission can waive them if they want. We could waive worth product if they want. That would be rare cases. How do we rub up against documents we received that we already have some information from our own and some that came to us from a government agreement or an agreement with the government, which is rare for us, very rare. And the commission can give guidance one way or the other. It does not suggest, and they emphasize that the brief of the Office of General Counsel is inaccurate in this regard, that it might somehow suggest that the commission can override the law. That's not our intention, or any existing privilege, or any existing work product privilege that exists. It simply provides for a method by which the commission can take control of the situation and make a decision one way or the other. The issue has come up, well, golly, can we really do this? I mean, can we really give these extra little bit of documents over to the other side because we're so burdened that we just may not be able to do this? And let me just say, and I've been practicing law for 37 years before I got here, mostly in litigation. This is done all the time. And I do think what it requires in order for us to do it is to have organized files in the office. I can't tell you whether they are or not because I've not looked at them ever that way. But as they proceed through an investigative case and they separate documents that are privileged, separate ones that are work product, separate ones that are, if they want, already known to the public, put those in or take them out. If you want to take them out, you can do that. Ones that are already in your possession, okay, we can take those out because we know you already have them, and leave with a pile. You say, then, all right, what documents would be produced in our probable cause brief? We're going to produce those anyway. So then what else is left if that's what we're talking about? And you find a set of documents there in one table over here, and it can be burdensome at that point to put them over here and say, take a look at them. And you, at your expense, you can copy whatever ones of those you want or do what most lawyers do in cases like this. They'll scan them and give them a CD, and the documents are available. I don't see there's a burden, and certainly I'm sensitive to our own budgetary requirements to do that, if we keep our files organized and know in advance that that's really what we're going to do. We basically do that anyway when we decide what documents we're going to put on for probable cause. We have to pull out and say, these documents or this information is available. What I think it will do is now make it more cognizant that they will be getting some potential exculpatory evidence, for example, or maybe documents that are relevant that they're not necessarily going to put in a probable cause brief that might be relevant to the case. so that the council on the other side has the opportunity to do this. So this is my best shot at trying to capitalize those considerations for consideration by the commission. I think it's time for us to do it. I don't think we should be afraid of being among those that are willing to implement the Brady considerations into our disclosure process. I think we're certainly capable of doing it without burdening the Office of General Counsel to such a degree that it justifies concealing documents from a respondent. I think we should consider there's a natural tendency, in my view, on the part of some governments to make it easier to keep documents secret than not to. I think that in our particular case, we're a disclosure agency. We're big on transparency. I think we should do it the same way. How can it hurt us to let the other side know that there's some case, there's some information that might be favorable to them? If we go to pre-probable cause because we concealed it, and then we're in litigation, they're going to find it all out in discovery anyway, in formal civil discovery in federal court. I don't think there's any document I'm proposing to make available that can't be discovered if we were in federal civil court and under normal federal rules of civil procedure. And the same protections apply there as well. So my view is, I've seen some of the things of concerns. I'm not concerned by those, but I do think there's ways in which we could ameliorate some of those by maybe some clarifying language, maybe ways to consider some other issues that appear when first read could justify clarification. But anyhow, that's my best pitch. I hope the commission will adopt it or something like it.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thank Commissioner Walther for his leadership on this issue and also for pushing to have a written codification of our policy on this. I think that's a really good move for us to do. I've had many conversations over the years with various people in our general counsel's office, some of whom are no longer in the building, about disclosure of exculpatory evidence. And I've always been in favor of it. I've always pushed to make sure that we were doing it. I am not aware of any commissioner that I've ever served of who was not in favor of disclosing any exculpatory or mitigating evidence to respondents. You know, I don't think there's any debate at all about that. And I've been assured at various points over the years that we were doing that. And I think that what happens without a written policy is one person's understanding may be different from another person's understanding, and what I thought two general counsels ago I was told made about this and assumed was still going on may not 100% reflect what's going on today with, you know, turnover in personnel and one person says something. You know, it's like a game of telephone, what Larry Norton told me and told somebody else and then got relayed to somebody else. You know, it just there just may be completely honest differences as to what the policy is supposed to be. So I think for those reasons, it's really a good idea, and I appreciate my colleagues' efforts to try and get something in writing. I think it's something that we've had a lot of internal discussions about this. I think it's something that would benefit from some comment from practitioners who practice in front of us. There's a couple of us at the table who have sat on the other side and represented clients, and apparently Commissioner McGann actually remembers all of my cases, some of them better than I do. Levin was an ADR case, I'm pretty sure.
Tierney was the murderer.
Yeah. That was one of the MERS. Anyway, you know, some of us have had that experience and some of us haven't, of sitting on the other side and seeing what the experience is like from the other side. And it's illuminating to see it from both sides, as I'm sure my colleague would agree. But I think that I've been on this side of the table longer now than I was on the other side, and I think it would be helpful to us to hear from practitioners on the exact parameters of what we ought to be doing here, and perhaps from other law enforcement agencies as well. One concern that I have is if we have a disclosure policy that is broader than that of other enforcement agencies, such as the Justice Department? How will that affect the level of cooperation that we get from those other enforcement agencies when we're seeking to share documents back and forth? And I know that there's a provision in here that I appreciate very much in Commissioner Walther's proposal that says specifically that if we have if anything has been disclosed to us by another law enforcement agency under an agreement that we're not going to disclose it, then we won't. And I think that's a very good and important provision. I think, though, that it's also possible that we could have information within our possession that we didn't get from another law enforcement agency but might be relevant to them as they pursue a criminal or other proceeding, that they might have a different perspective on whether it would harm the development of their case for us to disclose it at an earlier stage. You know, so I would like to actually, you know, send our drafts over to the Justice Department, to the Office of Public Integrity in particular, and just see what they think of it. Get some feedback from them, because I think that's an important perspective. I think it could potentially affect how the level of voluntary cooperation that we get from witnesses, particularly third-party witnesses. It's fairly unusual for us to have to issue subpoenas. Right now, we get a high degree of cooperation from people in terms of sharing information with us when we're doing our investigations, and I would hate to see that jeopardized. And I'm a little concerned that, one of the proposals in Commissioner Walther's proposal is that we would, whereas currently we share documents at the probable cause phase, we would share it at an earlier stage here whenever we would enter into conciliation. And at the same time, we would basically halt our own investigation. So we would be sharing with the other side pretty much whatever we have in our files. There's a discussion of the Brady Doctrine, but it's not limited to Brady Doctrine cases, Brady Doctrine information. So we would be sharing with the other side all of the information that we have at the time, without getting a lot back at that point, because we'd have to stop our investigation under this policy. And I wonder if that is actually the best way to get to the best informed conciliation agreement at the end of the day that adequately fleshes out all the issues. I think there are some serious and complicated issues around cases that involve multiple respondents. Because this happens, we've had cases that had 20 respondents, or maybe more. That one pops into my head because that was a complicated case. So we're getting information from a bunch of different respondents. They each have confidentiality rights under the statute, and the proposal in Commissioner Walther's draft is that we would ask them for to sign a waiver of those confidentiality rights in order to enable us to share this information among respondents. And we would do that on a routine basis. I'm not 100% sure that I feel comfortable with us routinely asking people to waive their confidentiality rights. It does not necessarily require that we would require a non-disclosure agreement. It says we might ask them for a non-disclosure agreement, but that would require four votes, and we might or might not have four votes at any one time. So I wonder about the position that we're putting multiple respondents, and each one of them has the same rights. Now, sometimes these multiple respondents are all on the same page. They have a community of interest. In which case, I think there is some potential for people to game the system. If there are people who have fairly low-level liability and they know it, they know we're not going to come after them very hard. They might try and structure the timing of their conciliation agreements to their conciliation negotiations to try and get information out of us at an earlier point that then could be fed to the bigger fish in the crowd so that that person would really have all of our cards open to them, although we wouldn't have all their cards open to us when we're negotiating with them at a later point. I think there's an even more serious problem if they have oppositional interests. I mean, we've had cases where we have multiple respondents and they're actually suing each other. At the same time, we're trying to investigate and conduct conciliation with them. You know, I think that they might have some strong concerns about our sharing information that we get from one of them with the other one. People who might otherwise say, you know, I want to be forthcoming with the government, I want to resolve this and get right with the law, but at the same time, I'm going after that other person that I think has done me wrong. You know, they might be less willing to share with us information that would help us resolve our issues at that point, because they want to hold back their information to make sure it's not shared with people that they are actively suing. You know, and this comes up actually fairly frequently. We get organizations and individuals. You know, there are individuals acting on behalf of the organization. The organization may claim they were acting without authorization. The individuals may claim, no, you knew exactly what I was doing all the time. There's any number of fact patterns that could involve people with opposite interests, and we may be placing them in an untenable situation where we are, you know, taking information from them and in some cases subpoenaing information from them and then handing it over to somebody that they're suing in court at the same time. So I think we really need to give some thought to this, and it would benefit from the comments of practitioners who are out there representing people who are in these positions. Now, I suspect that a lot of these practitioners will say, wow, this is really great. We would love to have all this information. You know, but I think some of them might, who have represented people, particularly in these multiple respondent cases, may have some concerns about it, may have some positive suggestions on how we could adjust the policy to make it better. So I think it would really, I mean, personally, I'd be in favor of, you know, putting it in the Federal Register and seeking formal comment. But at a minimum, I would think, you know, now that we have made a couple of different alternatives public, we should wait a couple of weeks and give an opportunity until the next meeting to have a formal vote on it so that we can give people an opportunity, should they choose, maybe nobody will, to weigh in and send us information and share those concerns. I will say that the proposal that Commissioner Walther has put forward is complicated. I'm not sure that I actually understand all the ins and outs of it as it's sitting in front of me today. I was going over it again yesterday, and it has evolved, and I think it's improved. But, you know, the reality is we were trading drafts up until about 6 o'clock last night. As a result of that, I'm still not 100% sure that I understand everything in there. And I think that's another reason why it might be a good idea to let some other folks take a look at it and give us their suggestions. I have, in conjunction with the chair, put forward another proposal, which is, you know, a different approach. It's modeled closely on the policy that FERC has, and I think is more in line with what a lot of other administrative agencies do. It's modeled more closely on the Brady Doctrine and sharing those documents, sharing them at the probable cause stage. You know, it's shorter. It's a lot shorter. Now, I'm not saying that policy is the perfect policy either. It's just an attempt to put out a different approach so that when people take a look at these things, they can look at them side by side and say, I like this part of this proposal, I like that part of that proposal, I you know, or I have an entirely different idea. I mean, we could, for example, use the rules of civil procedure as a model for what we ought to disclose. That's another possibility. We could look to the documents that we disclose at the end of a MER and say, well, we should just disclose those that entire file at an earlier point. We have been, you know, in the old days, we put everything on the public record at the end of a MIR, but we don't do that anymore. We've been told by a court that we can't do that, that we have to have a more tailored approach to disclosure. And I think in this regard as well, we need to have a tailored approach to what we're disclosing, because we're proposing, you know, it's easy in the one respondent case, you know, frankly, because most of the information comes from that person anyway. It gets a lot more complicated when we have multiple respondents. And we're talking about giving people other people's documents. It's not clear to me the way that the Commissioner Walther's proposal is written right now that even at the probable cause phase we could redact personal identifying information. If we had a, it seems to call for the disclosure of complete copies of documents. It's, you know, if a document was a bank statement or a credit card statement or something that contained somebody's you know, bank numbers or their credit card numbers or their social security number, it's not clear under this policy that we'd be able to redact that. And I think it just, you know, requires perhaps a little bit more thought and a little bit of editing. I'm not suggesting that's anybody's intention to do that, but I just want to make sure that the proposal that we ultimately adopt reflects adequate concerns for people's privacy rights. In addition to the confidentiality concerns under the statute, there's also privacy rights that all of us have in personal information that we might not want to be shared. And even if a document is only shared with one other person, as I said, if that one other person is the one person in the world that you least want to know that information, then that doesn't do you much good. You might prefer to give it to the man on the street than the guy that you're litigating against. You know, I think it's a bold Commissioner Walther's proposal is a bold proposal. It goes beyond what most agencies do. I'm not saying that we shouldn't go beyond what most agencies do, but I think we ought to do it in a thoughtful and well-informed way, and that you know, getting comments from people out there who are practicing would help us to craft a better policy at the end of the day, which we're all in favor of, you know. And I'll end where I began. You know, I have never served with any commissioner that was not in favor of the agency disclosing exculpatory and mitigating information to respondents. I think that is a principle that every commissioner has been in favor of. I have certainly been in favor of it. I have advocated for it internally. And I think this is, again, I appreciate Commissioner Walther's leadership in pushing us forward to a place where we codify these proposals and make the proposal itself public. I'll mention one other concern, actually, that I just thought of. There's a new proposal that we would create a withheld documents list, and we'd have to turn over document logs. It's not exactly clear to me, you know, would that include every single email that every staff attorney sent to their supervisor in the course of investigating a case? I'm not exactly sure what the scope of it is. I think it potentially could involve a fair amount of work for our lawyers. I think potentially we could, as commissioners, get involved in a lot of discovery type adjudication over whether particular documents should or shouldn't have been disclosed, whether certain confidential documents, certain privileged documents should under various circumstances be disclosed. I think that we have some aggressive practitioners out there who will be happy to take advantage of new procedures that we give them for appealing, at least to us, the documents that they receive or not. And that's why I think it would be important to do this as a pilot basis. The proposal that Chair Bowerly and I put forward includes that it would be a pilot program for a year, and then we would reconsider it. Actually, I think our proposal probably needs that feature less than the other proposal, because ours is more of a codification of what we're currently doing. So, you know, do we need a pilot program to continue doing what we're already doing? You know, possibly not. But I think if we're going to do something new that could turn out to be somewhat cumbersome for the agency to administer and not actually provide a lot of benefit for the cost of the agency, we might want to reconsider that down the road. And that's typically what we do when we do something new, is we do it as a pilot program, and then we give ourselves that automatic opportunity to refine it down the road. So I would strongly urge that whatever, if we're going to do something different, if we're going to expand what we're already doing and do something different, that we should do that as a pilot program so that we can adjust it down the road, not with an eye towards not disclosing exculpatory or mitigating information to anybody. As I said, nobody thinks that would be a good result. Nobody is advocating that we not disclose exculpatory or mitigating information. But the policy itself, the ins and the outs, may need to be refined over time, and I think we ought to build that in the way we do with other new programs. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to just to take this opportunity to clarify what I have in mind in this, so that it doesn't, take us in a direction that's different in the discussion. So I appreciate Commissioner Weintraub. I know she's been for most of these issues for some time, and I'm hopeful that we can sit here and think about all the potential problems that could be concerns forever, and we'll never get anywhere unless we decide how we're going to do it. And the way I did it is, when we can run up against something that's potentially an issue that we can't really imagine, it comes to the commission if the Office of General Counsel feels that that's important for us to get guidance. It's not an automatic trigger, well, we'll conceal it. It's a matter of coming to the commission and saying, something here, there's a potential way we could, our investigation could be injured. We don't think it's privileged, but it's sensitive, we'd like to get your guidance on it. Or we got information from the federal government, but we also got the information from George over here, and we think because it's available through George, and we can come to us and say, well, run it by justice first. I mean, it gives us an avenue to move to get this done without the automatic trigger being to conceal. For me, there are some things that I think are important. There seems to be some concern about whether or not to provide for discovery at the pre-probable cause conciliation stage. I can see the argument that can be made. Well, somebody will ask for pre-probable cause conciliation to help somebody else out. Okay, well, that would be a rare time. It's possible if we get really nervous about it, we could take that into consideration, but I really don't think that's something that we're going to find ourselves confronted with. The statistics that came to me recently show that in last year, 2011, there were 23 matters that are either in pre-probable cause conciliation or for which there's a pre-probable cause brief has been filed. As to the brief, 90% done. Likewise, for the year before, there was only 16. The year before, there was 31. In an office for a full year's time of over 100 lawyers and staff people, I don't see how most all of this that the commissioner indicated, we do it one way or the other. Either we automatically provide it or we automatically don't, but we don't have a procedure to help us decide how to get it done if there's an issue. I'm not suggesting that we turn over anything for which we have an obligation to conceal. I keep making that clear. For a multiple respondent case, if something is not able to be concealed in a multiple respondent case, it doesn't get concealed to anybody else. It doesn't get exposed to anyone else unless something gets worked out. And then, it could be a waiver, could be a redaction. A commission can say, well, we really got that information from somewhere else. But it gives us a way to not just automatically conceal the information, but to deal with it. I think timing is important, and I think if we decide we're going to wait until after, we've gone to pre-probable cause, that's all great, but is that really fair to somebody who's up against a pre-probable cause brief, and they get into litigation and find out, which I think was a potential in a recent matter, they get into litigation and find out, geez, you really knew something fairly, what I could consider to be exculpatory after all. I think we should give people the information. Like any of us who would be before a governmental investigation, the information that will either help or hurt your case when it's useful to them, and that's when you're in pre-probable cause conciliation. The whole idea is to try and settle a case. The best way to do it is when all the cards are on the table. We don't really ask at probable cause stage, well, what do you got? We say, what are you? Here's what we have. There's not necessarily an exchange in that case, but we, as the governmental agency moving against someone, has an obligation to make some disclosures. We can't say, give us all your witness list right now, and that kind of thing, but that would come later in the civil litigation. I think certainly, you know, there's no magic to this language, that's for sure. But I do think in nearly all instances for the multiple respondent situation, and instances where we've got information from maybe even a previous case. I think there was an issue. We had one case. We had information in a previous case that we didn't know whether to get it disclosed or not, so we asked for interrogatories to see if we could disclose it that way. These are all issues that we can deal with at the commission level if we need to, because the same issues that will be for us no matter what we do, we just don't have an automatic procedure except a knee-jerk to generally withhold. So, thank you.
Any further discussion? Commissioner McGann?
I hate to do this, Madam Chair. I know it's close to lunch, but I'm going to say just for two seconds, but I'm going to ask for like a 3-minute recess. I'm getting over a cold, and I'm sort of coughing and making a lot of noise, so I hate to be disruptive. But just while we're sort of in the discussion here, I'm glad to hear that several of us agree we need a written policy. There is a current policy. It's just in the air, like so many policies are, until they're reduced to writing, and it has at times been ad hoc, usually inadvertently. Sometimes it depends, you know, who the general counsel was in a particular error and what line attorney you may have been dealing with as to what gets turned over and when. As far as comment, I want to remind our colleagues that we did have a hearing some time ago about agency procedures generally, and this was one of the topics that was discussed, and there were comments on the need for this kind of policy, and we did get quite a few coherent suggestions, and I recall one in particular was quite detailed. Two, we've had real cases. There's cases before I've gotten here, there's cases since I've been here that illustrate some shortcomings in the current policy, and I think Commissioner Walter's right in that at the end of the day, much of what we're talking about are things that really the respondent will get eventually. It's just a question of when they get them. Third, why wait is what I wrote in my notes. And I understand the need, the concern about talking to DOJ and practitioners and whatnot, but as I said, we've already had a hearing. Practitioners have waited on the need for this. Two, we already turn over quite a bit of material at the probable cause stage. My guess is other agencies that may intersect with the FEC's jurisdiction from time to time probably wish we didn't even do that. So that's an issue that horse has already left the barn, so to say. And as a practical matter, dealing with the third party issue, I see that as part of a red herring, because although I could see specific cases where it gets tricky, that doesn't mean the policy is therefore tricky or complicated. And again, to be clear, the informal policy is at the probable cause stage, when the counsel relies on something in its brief, it gets turned over. So you get the deposition transcript or whatnot. The concern is that some think that maybe things aren't ending up in the brief because they don't want to necessarily show the respondent things or not. Whether that's the case or not doesn't matter. But that perception could be there, and that's an important perception that I think we need to address. So we're already operating under a procedure where things are being turned over, even if there are third parties or multiple respondents, or the respondents are blaming each other. Those are issues the commission has dealt with for 30 years. The commission will continue to deal with that, and I think Commissioner Walter's proposal has dealt with it in a thoughtful manner, and I think these issues have been thought through. Certainly, could there be an outlier that catches us by surprise? Sure, that's why it's a policy and not a formal one size fits all approach. But it is an important thing to do, because at the end of the day, I think people are going to be more likely to want to work with the agency and settle cases if they know that no one's playing hide the ball. And if the perception is out there that hide the ball is the game of choice, I think that prolongs matters that otherwise should settle. I've had experiences before I got here where the counsel's office has told me some things that weren't in the probable cause brief, and it's caused me to go to my client and take time to settle. So there's actually been benefits. There's been times where I've found out things after the fact that I wish I would have known, and neither me nor my client was particularly happy. And now I'm a commissioner, and one would think, well, you know, it's a different concern, but it's really not, because ultimately when that sort of thing happens, it makes the commissioners themselves look bad, and it makes it look like we're not committed to getting to the truth. After all, when we investigate, it ought to be that, an investigation. It's not a prosecution. Once it gets to the probable cause stage, then counsel becomes more of an advocate. But at the investigation stage, it's really more of a search for truth. And if we're searching for truth, it makes sense that of the remaining materials that the respondent wouldn't get in the administrative stage, which really isn't that much given what the current policy is, this is not causing all sorts of new documents to be disclosed. And I hate to do this. Can we have a recess for 3 minutes, Madam Chair, because I'm sort of...
Can I say something before you do that?
Sure, but okay.
I just wanted to comment on something that you said, you know, why wait? All I am suggesting is that we not vote for another 2 weeks. If you want to, I am willing to agree that we won't approve any conciliation agreements in the next 2 weeks to make sure that we are not disadvantaging anybody. But, you know, odds are that might not happen anyway. In order to give people an opportunity to comment on the specific proposals that we're contemplating. I mean, it's true that we got comment from folks at the hearing saying, you know, you should give us more documents. And there is no debate at the table that we should have a written policy. There's no debate at the table that we should be disclosing exculpatory and mitigating evidence. But, you know, the devil's sometimes in the details. And in order to make sure that the policy that we adopt is the most well-informed policy, I don't see that there's any harm in waiting for 2 weeks to give people an opportunity to weigh in on it. But I will stop now so that we can have our recess.
We'll take a 5-minute recess. We are actually, it seems to be the preference that we're going to take a break for lunch. And so we will resume this meeting at 1:30. Thank you. The open meeting will resume. Before lunch, we were discussing Commissioner Weintraub's suggestion that we hold this matter over for additional time for comment. In general, we regularly agree just by consensus to hold over matters when our colleagues ask for additional time to consider a matter. In this case, Commissioner Weintraub is suggesting that additional public comment would be useful to the specifics of these procedures. I hear my colleagues that we have, you know, we did have a procedure hearing a little over a year ago, year and a half ago, perhaps. But obviously, this is a very specific proposal. In fact, there are two proposals. And I, for one, think it would be very useful to get some meaningful public comment on that proposal. So normally, we just hold things over to the next scheduled meeting, which in this case is May 26th. Vice Chair Hunter.
And somebody brought up, I can't remember who it was, the possibility of scheduling an additional meeting. And over the lunchtime, I was able to confer with some of my colleagues, and I proposed having an additional meeting on Friday the 13th of May. And that, yeah, I know. Friday the 13th. Yeah, that sounds like a good time as any. I think the chair, I believe you said you might have had a scheduling conflict that day, so maybe Thursday the 12th in the afternoon, if that works. Works for us.
Commissioner Weintraub.
As the chair noted, we normally hold matters over as a matter of course. We don't schedule special meetings. We just put it over to the next meeting. All these meetings were scheduled based on people's calendars. If you say, you know, we have to do it next week, that's like saying we are we really don't want comment. We don't want to give the public an adequate chance to actually read these documents and provide public comment. We're not interested in what they have to say. We want to schedule this at the earliest possible moment, have a special session just so we can vote this out without considering public comment. I think, you know, earlier it was said, you know, we shouldn't be afraid to disclose to the public whatever documents we have. Well, we also shouldn't be afraid to hear what people have to say before we vote on a document. What are you afraid of? Why the big rush? Who's going to be harmed if we wait for the next open meeting and give the public an adequate chance to read the documents, which are complicated, and say, you know, gee, what's in this one? What's in that one? What do we like? I think the odds are, I literally don't know what you're afraid of, because the odds are that we will get comments from lawyers who represent respondents who will say, wow, we love that proposal. That's great. But I think it's also possible that we'll get some comments that say, you know what, that's a great idea, but I have a suggestion for improving it. And I personally would like to hear that. It's only going to result in a better policy at the end of the day. And there's absolutely no downside that, you know, if there's a harm in our waiting 3 weeks to do this, I would like to hear what that is.
Mr. Hunter.
I think as we've said earlier, we're ready to vote on it right now.
But what's the harm in waiting 3 weeks? I understand you're ready to vote on it now. I understand you've made up your mind. Don't care what anybody else has to say. I understand that.
That's not what I said. I said we're ready to vote on it right now. And because our colleagues are interested in getting public comment on this, we're willing to put it out for a week. We think that's a reasonable amount of time.
Never put anything out for 1 week for public comment. When was the last time? Come up with one example where we said we wanted public comment and we're giving you 1 week.
We've done plenty of policies since I've been here that we haven't put out for any public comment.
Most of those were pilot projects.
I don't know.
Every AO is a week, sometimes
less. Every AO is a week or sometimes less.
And those AOs are always put on the public record to give people an opportunity for public comment.
And now these are on the public record. There's three documents on the public record right now. And as you know, we've been talking about this internally for months and months and months. And I think one of the concerns one of my colleagues raised earlier was that OGC has some questions about the document. And that's obviously reasonable. And I think a week would give OGC ample opportunity to ask technical questions, you know, ask specific questions about the document production list or whatever. I mean, that seems reasonable, but I think a week is more than enough time.
AOs, the request is put out there in advance so that people know the topic is out there. Sometimes people comment on the request. Sometimes people comment on the responses and the request. Nobody knew that we were doing this. This is the first time that, you know, and it obviously didn't generate a lot of public attention because nobody, very few people showed up other than our loyal scribe to hear this discussion, which I think is an important discussion. I don't expect we're going to get a boatload of comments, but I think we will get some comments, and I think they will be useful if we give people an adequate amount of time. The people who are most likely to comment are lawyers who are busy people and can't drop everything because we say, oh, we are scheduling a special session in 1 week to make sure that you have the minimal amount of time so that we can give lip service to public comment without actually providing an adequate opportunity to do it. And I'm still waiting for what is the harm in waiting for the next public meeting other than the fact that you want to do it now. I understand you want to do it now, but what's the harm in what is the loss? What's the harm in waiting for the doing what we do in every other case, which is somebody's got a concern, we hold it over to the next meeting. I can think of things that you guys have held over for months while you wanted to contemplate changes to documents. And, you know, I'm talking about a couple of weeks. It's just completely unreasonable.
Commissioner McGann.
Under the directives, if commissioner wants to hold something over, it's their prerogative. So going back and forth saying, well, you guys have held stuff over, that we all know that's not really the point. The problem I see is this is a commission procedure that concerns how the commission conducts its enforcement. I come back to the fact we have had a hearing. This has been discussed. You say that every commissioner has been in favor of exculpatory evidence ever. Place has been here, well, how many years? 30 plus? Now all of a sudden, everyone finds that, oh, yeah, everybody's always been in favor of this. Why is it taking this long? We have cases ongoing now, and I can't get into details because all that is confidential under the statute. And I guess you could say, what's the big deal of over 3 weeks? But, you know, who knows? Maybe there's cases ongoing. Maybe there's not, where this actually is going to matter to a real respondent. Merely saying we won't sign any conciliation agreements for a couple weeks really isn't the issue, because this concerns more factual information. Second, I'm still people may file comments. They may be good. They may be bad. They may be indifferent. But part of what they're commenting on is an unknown, because unless you actually work at the FEC, half of this doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense, because it's based entirely on the perception of the commissioners and the general counsel's office in a confidential enforcement matter. So it's tough for people to file meaningful comment on some of this, particularly the issues you've raised, the third-party issue, which to me is not that big an issue because we already deal with that in Murray after Murray after Murray at the probable cause stage. So a lot of this is tough. People want to file comments, they certainly can. I'm always open for input. But, you know, unless we really open the door to all the nuances of what goes on behind closed doors, you know, we can jump up and down and talk about public comment all we want, but it's not meaningful public comment. Moreover, this policy, without getting the details, we've talked about this in executive session already, because there are issues the council wanted to address to the commission behind closed doors. Can people comment on that? No. I don't hear anyone suggesting that people can come in and listen to that discussion. You only want to hear the discussion that we've sanitized for the public on this. There's a lot of stuff here that is both public and private. Private in the sense that it is procedures within the commission, where it's the commissioners themselves that are in the best position to know what to do to solve very real problems. The problem is going to be here today, just as it's going to be here in 2 weeks from now. And it commissioner wants to hold it over, commissioner can hold it over. And once the commissioner says, I want to hold it over, the debate ceases. That's how the directives work. I haven't heard that. I've heard maybe hold it over, so we're still talking about it. But if you want to hold, you can hold. But let's be honest about what we're doing here, and what, if there are comments, what the comments are commenting on. They're commenting on a procedure that part of it's already behind closed doors, and its application happens behind closed doors. So for people out there listening to this, and just because people didn't show up to listen, that doesn't mean people aren't paying attention. This is being broadcast on the web. I know people listen, so hello all of you in cyberland. File comments, but realize when you file comments, you don't even know all the discussion the commission's had on this, because this does go to the heart of the internal enforcement procedures of the commission, which are not public. Maybe they should be. Maybe the enforcement manual should be public, but it's not. There were comments. The enforcement manual is public?
We've got an enforcement manual that's public.
It is? The entire manual is public?
Guidebook.
There's a guide.
Oh, right. But there is a secret manual.
Right.
It's not public. Right? Can I go in my office and get it and make copies and hand it out? No. So this goes to that juncture. Pardon?
I'm willing to consider that if you want.
I'll move right now. We make it public.
I'm willing to consider it, meaning I want to go back and look at what's in it.
Maybe we'd add that for comment.
Part of it. As you know, I have long advocated that we make our penalty schedule public, which I think is one of the things that's in the enforcement manual that there's been concern about making public. If you want to, you know, go through that document and see what more we can make public, I'm happy to do that.
Okay, while we're on it, if we're going to get comment on this, another issue that arises in the sua sponte submissions. People put in a sua sponte, and then when it's served, it's not really served. They get a letter saying you did something wrong, says someone else, please respond. That, I think, intersects with this policy, perhaps. People may want to comment on our sua sponte policy. We have an interim disclosure policy since 2003. Still kind of what we're doing. There was a promise made then in 2003 there was going to be a permanent policy made in effect. That's still not done. I still haven't seen a tangible proposal to make penalties public. I've suggested some things in executive session. They've gone nowhere.
Your suggestions were to change the penalty schedule and then make it public. So that's why your proposal didn't go public, because there were not four votes for the way you wanted to change the penalty schedule.
But in that case, that was the penalty, so that would have been something that actually does become kind of something that matters. That being said, look, if you want to hold it, you can hold it. But those on the outside have to understand that you're commenting on a document that is a procedure that if there are things that they don't think is clear, that's helpful. But a lot of this is in the enforcement process, and there's already been discussions and commission deliberation that's outside of the view of the public. So for comments, it gets kind of tricky. But with that, I just wanted to make it clear that this is not as simple as, why don't we want comment? There's a lot more to it.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have had, for as long as I've been here, an informal policy on disclosure of exculpatory information. And so you say, well, why has it taken 30 years? Well, there was an informal policy. And as I said earlier, wait, let me finish. I let you finish. Let me finish. I said this morning that I think it is a good idea to put it in writing. I agree that without something in writing, there are, it could get implemented inconsistently. People might have different understandings of it. It is a good idea. I'm in favor of putting it in writing. I said so this morning. I still think it's a good idea. What we would be asking for public comment on are the specifics of the proposals that are, have been put on blue paper today. And there are, you may think there's nobody out there who's in a position to give meaningful comment on that, but I actually disagree with you. I think there are a lot of people who are sensitive to the issues of confidentiality when representing multiple respondents because they've done it, and they might want to think about it. And I also know, as you do, that there are actually quite a number of attorneys out there who represent clients who have worked here in the past and actually do have some insight into how the process works internally. And there are former commissioners out there who are practicing in this area. I can think of several off the top of my head, former heads of enforcement, former attorneys from former EAs, former attorneys from the Office of General Counsel. There's plenty of people out there who are practicing right now and have that both of those perspectives, the perspective of somebody on the outside, and they actually know how things work on the inside. I think those comments would be particularly meaningful to us. But, in answer to your, invitation, I'll take it as that if I want to have it held over, it can be held over. Let me state formally that I wish to have it held over till the next meeting because I believe that it will be a better document at the end of the day. Maybe we won't change one comma and it'll get adopted at the next meeting. Okay, fine, but at least we will not close our ears to what anybody else who doesn't happen to work in this building might have to say on the subject.
Commissioner McGann.
Can I ask one question just to clarify something you said? You mentioned the policy and you characterized the current informal policy as an exculpatory evidence policy. Is it currently the policy of the commission that exculpatory evidence is turned over to a respondent, exculpatory in a broader sense of the word, not simply something that is direct proof that someone didn't do it, but circumstantial or impeachment evidence that would impeach a witness? Because my understanding of the current commission policy is that there is no policy to turn over exculpatory evidence. The policy is things relied upon by the counsel in the probable cause brief get turned over. But if it's not relied upon in the counsel brief, it doesn't get turned over. So to the extent that there is a policy, let's at least be clear to the public as to what the policy is before we have them comment on something that may or may not already exist.
Mr. Weintraub, as counsel conferring,
counsel
I haven't forgotten about your question, Commissioner.
No, I just wanted to say it is my understanding, that was my belief, certainly, that we do turn over exculpatory evidence to respondents, but I'll defer to counsel on that. But indeed, if there is confusion about that, that shows yet another benefit to putting something in writing, which we are all in favor of.
Not to editorialize, but if the policy is the policy, should be an easy question to answer.
Ms. Guth.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair, what we currently strive to do is provide information in the brief that we are relying on in support of our probable cause recommendation, and information which we don't know is already in the possession of respondents that we would want their answer to, so that when we go back to the commission and recommend probable cause or not, we have full information. So in certain cases, that would include in the brief information that may be considered mitigating or exculpatory. In some cases, there will be no such information. In many, as you know, there's only a certain percentage of our matters that reach that stage, and those that do, a smaller percentage deal with matters where we've conducted an investigation or received information from people other than the respondent that is receiving the brief. And so in many of our cases, the only information we've received is from the respondent themselves. But where we think that the respondent may not have information that's exculpatory, we try to put that in the brief so that we can get a response and include that in our overall recommendation to the commission.
Commissioner McGann.
Follow-up question. But under the statute at the probable cause stage, the statute says the Office of General Counsel recommends probable cause, and then the respondent files a brief and therefore gets the last word. I'm not following you when you talk about you put it in to see what the respondent says, and then you see what you're going to do in your recommendation. The recommendation's already been made, isn't it? I mean, that's how the statute reads.
No, just to clarify that, the recommendation is not made. What the brief says specifically is that here's the information on which we are prepared to recommend, and we obviously invite them to submit to us additional information which could alter what our view is as to what our recommendation will be once we ultimately make a recommendation to the commission.
Follow up on that. So what you're saying is the initial brief is just an intent to recommend. There's a response, and then the real recommendation comes after.
That's correct.
Okay. Let me just read the statute. 437A3. The general counsel of the commission shall notify the respondent of any recommendation to the commission by the general counsel to proceed to a vote on probable cause pursuant to paragraph 481. With such notification, the general counsel shall include a brief stating the position of the general counsel on the legal and factual issues of the case. Within 15 days of receipt of such brief, respondent may submit a brief stating the position of such respondent on the legal and factual issues of the case and replying to the brief of general counsel. Such brief shall be filed with the secretary of the commission and be considered by the commission before proceeding under paragraph 4. And paragraph 4 is where, if there's 4 votes, there's probable cause. But the statute says any recommendation is to be served on respondent, and they get the last word. Now, what you're telling me is they don't. You get the last word.
The brief itself is our position at the time we serve the brief. And yes, the respondent is given an opportunity to provide additional information which may in fact result in a recommendation to the commission that there's not probable cause to believe. So they do have an opportunity to present to us additional information that there's not probable cause to believe. We wouldn't at that point be receiving any additional information supporting probable cause because the only final information submitted is from the respondents themselves.
But what I'm hearing you say is that the actual recommendation occurs after the respondent files the brief, which is the inverse of what the statute contemplates. The statute contemplates the respondent getting the last word, and the respondent gets to respond to your recommendation. Now, you may wonder what this has to do with exculpatory evidence, but it has everything to do with it because it gets to the heart of the matter as to what the respondent knows and when he knows it. And if we're not following the statute at the probable cause stage, and I would suggest based upon what we've been told here today, the commission is not following the statute, we have bigger problems than exculpatory evidence. But the statute could not be clearer that at the probable cause stage, the counsel makes a recommendation. It doesn't say just the first or initial or the, it says any recommendation that gets served and there's a response. But you're telling me there's a recommendation after the after respondent files a brief that they don't get to respond to.
Correct. What is contained in the brief is the information we have at that time upon which we are prepared to recommend to the commission that there's probable cause to believe. The respondents have an opportunity to respond to that. Subsequent to them responding responding to it, if they so choose, we do forward to the commission our recommendation as to whether or not there is probable cause to believe, and the commission thereafter votes as to whether there's probable cause to believe.
How does that square with the statute? I mean, I could see certainly after the respondent files a brief, counsel's free to say, you know what, they make a good point, we're not going to recommend probable cause, they've talked us out of it. The regulations contemplate that. That's why there's a reg. But the statute itself couldn't be clearer on the point, and I can't square what you're saying with what I'm reading here in the statute book.
Again, our final recommendation to the commission will not contain any additional information supporting a recommendation for probable cause. If any new information is contained within the recommendation, it would be information received from a respondent themselves, and presumably information which, if anything, argues against probable cause to believe.
Then why doesn't the respondent get a chance to respond to that? If it's not that big a deal and there's nothing new, what's the harm in following the statute and letting them have the final word as contemplated by the statute?
They've already received the information upon which our recommendation is based and have had an opportunity to respond to it. This final recommendation is simply adding the layer of respondent's own response.
But if the statute contemplates the respondent having the final word, why does the council need to put a gloss on the respondent's response? Haven't they already put their own gloss on their response?
Under that approach, there would be an opportunity for the general counsel's office to consider changing its recommendation based on the final submission of the respondent. In other words, we would be unable to reconsider what we would recommend ultimately to the commission.
That's all I have for now.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification, when you were describing what the current policy is or the current practice, you say that in the brief that served to respondents that we typically, or it's a practice of ours to include exculpatory or mitigating evidence. But that would seem to indicate that there are occasions or times and there's not necessarily a requirement that exculpatory information does get put into the brief. And in those instances where there is exculpatory information in the possession of the commission that's not in the brief, do we hand that over as a matter of course to the respondents?
If I understood your question, are you asking if we would hand it over post-brief if we received something that was exculpatory?
Well, no, I'm just saying that you say that the practice is to include exculpatory evidence or at least mitigating evidence in the brief. But it doesn't sound like that's a hard and fast requirement, which would indicate that there are occasions where there may be exculpatory information that's not included in the brief that's served upon respondent. And so in those instances, is it the commission's policy to provide that information, even though we're not relying on it or referencing it in our brief, do we still hand over that information to respondents?
Well, as I stated, this issue just doesn't come up very often, and the number of cases in which we proceed to this stage doesn't happen in a large percentage in relation to our overall docket. And so I couldn't necessarily say in every case. And I do think that because some of the points Commissioner Weintraub made earlier, I think, are in fact the case. We have 30 different line attorneys interpreting an informal policy in different ways. And so I imagine that different things have happened in different cases. Our goal is to try to, again, provide respondents if we think they don't have a piece of information that might be exculpatory and could, in fact, be material to our overall recommendation to the commission. We want to provide it to them so they have an opportunity to respond to that information.
Commissioner Peterson.
If I can just add in my two cents. Obviously, this is, we won't be... I'd be happy to supporting this policy today, but it looks like we're going to be moving on. I think for the reasons that Ms. Guth pointed out, I think that having a written policy would be extremely helpful so we don't have multifarious interpretations of what's going on. And it's also why I like the approach that that Commissioner Walther has with his document, where we define exculpatory information, but we don't say we turn over documents. Basically, the rule is we turn over documents, and then we look at the next part of the reg, or the policy, which then we withdraw certain documents, you know, for privilege reasons, for reasons dealing with we receive them from another governmental entity under an agreement not to disclose that, which gets the commission out of the business of deciding what's exculpatory and what's not, because we're probably not in the best position to determine what's exculpatory and what's not. And I think that that's one of the real virtues of the way that this is structured, because I think that that puts OGC, frankly, in a really kind of an odd position, because what's exculpatory to one person may not seem exculpatory to another, but the policy as it's drafted under Commissioner Walther's proposal would get us out of that box, and we'd eliminate certain classes of documents that wouldn't need to be turned over for the various reasons we've discussed, but it wouldn't put us in that position where we have to make calls which are better left, I frankly, for opposing counsel, for respondents counsel to make. So anyway, I just wanted to say at this point that I'm supportive of Commissioner Walther's policy and look forward to voting on it when we get the chance. Thank you.
Vice Chair Hunter.
Thank you. One quick question to follow up on the line of questioning that Commissioner McGinn was asking. At this point now, the probable cause brief, the first one where you recommend what you're going to do, does that brief contain discussions of anticipated arguments by respondents, or is that saved for the next report?
I think it probably differs by brief, but we definitely in many briefs try to anticipate what respondents' arguments are going to be, because again, we want to hear what they have to say about those arguments and get their responses to them.
Thank you. Part of my confusion, really, since I've been here on a lot of this stuff, is it is hard for me to tell what OGC's position is. And I have this old book in my office that I refer to all the time, and I get in trouble from the enforcement attorneys because I always say, please put that book away. That's an old policy. But I really don't know what the new one is, so it's a little hard to deal with. There are things in the secret book that I have now that are completely contrary to the descriptions that we've heard today and other days. I believe that they're different, just with all due respect to the way that Commissioner Weintraub believes the policies are happening. And I think that's part of the problem. And it also goes to Commissioner McGann's point of, I'm not really sure how the public is supposed to provide meaningful comment on this with so much of it kind of up in the air. And to follow up on what Commissioner Peterson said, I did hear counsel to say that there is not a hard and fast rule to turn over exculpatory evidence. And I think the memorandum that was submitted this morning from OGC reiterates that point. I mean, there are several points in here where it says it's a sort of case-by-case thing, and we have to make sure that we're not breaching confidential information and all that sort of thing. So I guess if I'm trying to put myself in the shoe of the public trying to figure this out, it's going to be pretty tough, because I don't think that they're operating with a full
picture of what's going on, and I don't even know what the full picture is, and I've been here for almost 3 years. One last thing is, I forgot what was the last thing I was going to say. I had another good point. I'm sure it was a very good one, but I can't think of it right this second. But just for the record, I too would be willing to vote for this right now. Maybe in the next 24 hours or so, we can think of other things that might be useful to put on the public record. So to the extent people have other information they might want to look at when they're trying to figure out how to comment on this, that potentially could be useful.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to belabor this, but this notion that, oh my gosh, how is the public ever supposed to figure out how to comment on this? We do this all the time. We've got a couple of documents that we're putting before the public. We're asking them to comment on those documents. Now, one of the virtues of having documents is that we will eliminate the confusion over what exactly is the policy or isn't the policy or should be the policy or what this attorney might believe or that attorney might believe. I completely am on board with putting something in writing to eliminate that problem. I'm 100% support it. And that we've got a couple of proposals that are in writing in detail, and people can look at those and say, is that the policy that we think the FEC ought to have based on, you know, and I assume most of the, you know, we could get comments from anybody, but I would assume that most of the comments, and I don't imagine we'll get a huge number, will be from practitioners, people who do business before the agency, and they will sit down and look at these documents and say, is that the way I think the agency ought to do business, or do I have a better idea? And if they do, I want to hear it. Maybe nobody will. Maybe you'll end up voting for exactly the same document in 3 weeks that is before you today. Fine, then. You know, at least at the end of the day, we will then have something in writing, which we all want. We will have clarity. And I think that there is, you know, the only other point that I would make is that it's always been my understanding and my intent that we should produce exculpatory evidence to respondents. I've always said that to various general counsels over the years. It's always been my understanding that's what we're doing. To the extent we're not doing it, we should be doing it. And I certainly assume that that's what the written policy, whatever it is, will say at the end of the day.
So any further discussion? Commissioner Walker.
I think the important discussion, it's important for us to discuss exculpatory evidence, but this policy that I'm hoping to see the commission adopt talks about negative evidence, too. What hurts your case? I mean, that's important for a counsel to know also. And I think if we want to be fair with counsel and the commission, everybody at the probable cause stage ought to be pretty much up on exactly what that is. And so exculpatory evidence, if I look at the counsel's brief here that they came in mid-meeting, there's problems hand-wringing all over the place about this policy. And, you know, it's a lot of agencies use it. They get along fine. And it's the fair thing to do. So I hope that attitude will be reconsidered. So that's just my thought. And certainly I'm ready to vote anytime.
All right. We'll look forward to public comment on these documents, and we'll hold them over to the next open meeting, where I assume we will be taking a vote on them in one way or the other and finally put something in writing. Ms. Carmona, are there any management or administrative matters?
There are none, Chair Bowerly.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.